Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
For years and years, very few people knew the story of Helmut Huebner. He was a German Mormon teenager in Hamburg who ignited a brief but bold moment of resistance to the Nazis. And maybe the story is forgotten because there are quite a few of these small acts of resistance, Germans who couldn't reconcile their consciences with what they knew or were learning about Hitler and the war. But Huebner's story, it's incredible. He would listen in secret to these BBC broadcasts on his brother's radio, and he heard what the Nazis were hiding about the costs of war and their atrocities. And so he used the typewriter of his church branch, his ward, and he carefully wrote out these leaflets about the war's futility and the Nazi lies. And he recruited friends from the ward, including a boy named Karl Heinz Schnibbe, to carry them throughout the city, to put them in mailboxes and on bulletin boards in these public places. Now, eventually, they were caught and they were arrested and brought to trial. And Huebner managed to sustain that sense of defiance, but he was executed at age 17. When the filmmaker Matt Whitaker learned about this story, this was about 20 years ago, it was still pretty obscure, but Huebner's childhood friend, Karl Schnibbe, he was still alive. In fact, he ended up not far from where Whitaker himself was living. So Matt Whitaker made a documentary about Huebner, and now he's made a feature film, which is just out in theaters, called Truth and Treason. And there's a moment in the film that Whitaker described for us at Huebner's trial, where this young man stood up to Hitler one more time.
Throughout this whole film, Helmut has been given opportunities to stand up. And at first, you know, he just doesn't have the wherewithal, doesn't have the courage. But he does start to take a stand when he starts putting out these leaflets.
Do you know the country without freedom? The country of terror and tyranny? Yes, you know it well, but are afraid to talk about it. It is Germany. Hitler, Germany.
And once he gets caught and gets broken, you wonder if he's ever going to be able to stand up again. So here, Helmut is, this barely 17-year-old kid in the highest court in Nazi Germany. And he's been broken by the Gestapo. And he's been given a choice. They've given him the opportunity to put all the blame on his friend Carl, who was a year older, who was 18, who was an adult.
Your Honor,
my client has prepared a written confession which demonstrates very clearly that he was bullied into this resistance group by his older friend here, Herr Schnibbe.
Bring him forward.
And so as Helmut is sitting before this Hitler-appointed judge, he has that choice. He could throw his friend under the bus and get off. Or, one more time, he could stand up.
I, Helmut Huebner, express my deepest regrets.
In that moment, Helmut sets down the confession letter that had been prepared for him by his Hitler-appointed attorney. And he says that Germany's going to lose this war.
I express my deepest regrets that Germany has followed a lunatic into a war she cannot win.
No. This is a court of law. The accused is free to speak. Well, that's quite the statement. Do you really believe that Germany will lose this war?
Absolutely. Don't you?
And it gets under the skin of the judge.
And how did we arrive at this great juncture in history?
On the backs of the conquered. That's how we arrived here. The power of this Reich is mired in the blood of the innocent.
And this is when the judge asks Helmut,
What did you think, boy? That you'd write some little leaflets and overthrow the Reich?
I thought I would write the truth and let it overthrow the Reich.
The Reich doesn't fear your little papers.
Then why are we here?
After all of this, after embarrassing the judge, exposing the facade of Nazi Germany, the sentence comes down, and Helmut is sentenced to death. Ever since I discovered this story, ever since Karlheinz Schnibbe told me in person his firsthand account of sitting in that courtroom and watching his best friend take his final stand for truth, there's been a question in my mind. What would I have done? Would I have stood up like that? If I'm honest, especially with a wife and kids, I probably wouldn't have. But I also ask myself the question, what will I do now? And as I look around me, as I look at what's happening in the world, but not just in the world, in our country, the rise of authoritarianism, the rise of a neo-fascism, what's happening in our country right now transcends party politics and we're in danger. And if Helmut's example can inspire me to stand up and speak truth to power in my little way, then I'm going to try and do it, try and be like Helmut. And hopefully this film can inspire others to do the same.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Helmut Hubner's story. We have with us the film's director, Matt Whitaker. Also, Alan Keel is with us. He's a scholar, a former professor at Brigham Young University, who's written a lot about Hubner's story. And we began with Alan Keel and his own discovery of the story, which came through the work of the acclaimed German novelist Günter Grass.
I had done my PhD at Princeton and had finished in 71 and had taken a job at BYU. And I had been wrote a dissertation on the topic of post-war German literature. And in the course of that, I became very fascinated with Günter Grass. So it was clear to me then that this was a towering, monumental figure. He put German literature back on the map with the Tin Drum in 1959.
Yeah.
And so I was systematically reading his works, and I read the so-called Danzig trilogy, which starts with the Tin Drum. There's two other novels that follow that. And then the very next novel he wrote was in 69, and it was called Local Anesthetic. And so I was systematically reading that, and I got to it in 71, so I was only a couple of years behind. And there I encountered the name Helmut Hubner, because he was using in that novel Helmut as a kind of mythic example for young people in Germany today to follow. And so he's trying to teach people not to be radical, because they wanted to burn each other, they wanted to burn the city down. Point is, then I ran across this, and I found that it was based on an article that Grass had found in an obscure labor union newspaper from Hamburg. What had happened is a young man named Ulrich Sander in school had been given a school assignment, his class. Go home, ask your parents, ask your neighbors, did they know anybody in the resistance during the war? Mm-hmm. It turns out his dad had heard the name Helmut Hubner. So Uli did this research, and he wrote this article, or the school essay. He got an A on it, of course, very proud, and he happened to know the editor of this little newspaper, so he put it in there as an article. And this is a bizarre thing, but Grass happened to have a
subscription
to this strange little newspaper. So in the novel, the kid who's the most likely radical but has the most potential as a writer is visited by his teacher at home, and there the kid has already found the example of Helmut Hubner. So he now teaches the teacher. So I was fascinated by it. I got a hold of the article, and there I found the names of his fellow his friends and co-conspirators, Rudi Vaube, Karl Schnibbe, and the names of a bunch of others. And to my shame, I didn't immediately think about Salt Lake City. But at one point, I had the idea, and it suddenly hit me, wait, didn't some Mormons immigrate to Utah after the war? I wondered if any of them did. So I grabbed the Salt Lake phone book, and I looked up the name Carl Schnibbe, and there it was, 272-5773. Wow. I dialed Carl. He answered. He said, I've been waiting for this call for 25 years. So that's how that got started.
So you discover the story among the books you write, When Truth Was Treason. And it's at this point, Matt Whitaker, that you come in sort of into the story, because that's when you learned?
Well, almost precisely 30 years later. So in 2001, I was a documentary filmmaker at the time. I was doing another World War II documentary. A member of my crew asked me, have you ever heard of Helmut Hubner? And I hadn't. I didn't know anything about it. Hmm. He said, you know, he kind of said, you know, the 16-year-old kid who stood up to Hitler. He was a Mormon kid, you know, and I said, well, I'm interested. He said, I think that the last surviving member of the group, I think he lives in Salt Lake. So very similarly, we opened up the phone book. We found Carl Heinz Schnibbe, same number, 272-5773.
There we go.
Called him on the phone and said, hey, will you share your story with us? And Carl said, yeah, sure, come on over. And that visit, so my first exposure really was from the source, firsthand from Carl giving a short version of the story in his home. And then when I walked out of his house that day, I just knew I had to share that. I didn't know it was going to change my life, but I knew I had to share this story with the world. So that's when I found out, oh, there was a book already written. Carl said, here, you got to read this book about. Off we went. Yeah, interviewed Carl on film, got a comprehensive interview on June 6th, 2001. And that's where it really started for me in earnest. Hmm.
Let's talk about Helmut Hubner himself. The question I want to ask is, what was he like? Which seems like a kind of dopey first question, but what was he like?
It's interesting because I've found in my research, and a lot of that's based off of research, Alan, that you've done, but I found in some ways conflicting firsthand accounts of, because some people will say he was quiet, he was just studious and a good kid, and his teachers describe him as being kind of just this really good studious young student. But at the same time, Carl will talk about, you know, in church, that he enjoyed, he was maybe a little bit smarter, knew the doctrine better than some of the older brethren, and didn't mind kind of putting them on the spot. Yeah, I see a kid who's, there's a complexity there, because he was brilliant. I think there was a kind of a studious, timid nature to him, but at the same time, he liked being known as the man with knowledge.
The man with the answers. Yeah.
Yeah, the man with the answers.
Do you think he's a myth in some ways, that he's come to become a kind of myth, hard to sort of pin down as an ordinary German schoolboy?
Well, I'm going to put on my Dr. Freud hat and say that I think you have to – this is a little bit painful to talk about, but you have to understand that he was born out of wedlock. Hmm. And I think there's a kind of compensation for this fact. His clothing was meticulous. His hair was always in place. He really did sometimes like to ask questions of older people who didn't know the answers and so forth. And he kind of reveled in that a bit, he said. So I don't know. It's hard to – well, we do have the advantage of having his very close, close friends who gave us, you know, limitless hours of testimony about him. Yeah. So it's not like he's some incognito guy that we've never heard about before. But I think he's a little bit complicated. I think the good clearly outweighs the, you know, there's really no bad in my view of Helmut.
Complicated.
Yeah.
Which kind of gets us to something you say, Alan, in Matt Whitaker's documentary, was that he was a reasonably intelligent person, but he wasn't a genius. Explain what you were getting. Yeah. It seems like you were trying to sort of deflate some sort of mythic character.
What happened in that documentary was that Douglas Tobler was on camera having said, and I normally don't disagree with Doug ever, but he said, you know, he was such a marvelous genius and so forth. And I thought, well, that sort of undercuts the idea that he would be a model for other people, right? If he's somehow on such a high pedestal that no one else could possibly ever figure things out like he did, then that sort of defeats the whole purpose. And that was my thinking. Point is, if he were such a once-in-a-lifetime genius, an Einstein, then how could we be expected to emulate him? And to me, that's the whole point of the Hubner story, is that we all need to start emulating him.
So can I just chime in? And I'm maybe just counter a little bit what you're saying, Alan. I read, you know, there are 29 of however many leaflets he wrote, which was more than that, but there are 29 that survived. I read those and try and imagine a 16-year-old kid writing those. And
Without AI?
Yeah. It's brilliant. It really is brilliant, which is why the Gestapo was looking for a university professor.
Right.
So I think that there is.
So what are you seeing in those? But I want to come back to that actually, because his sort of, it seemed like he had a technique, a kind of literary charisma that may have worried the Nazis. Is that right to say?
Yeah, he also got personal. You know, he made fun of Goering for his weight. He made fun of Goebbels for other things. Wrote that poem about Goebbels, and so he was getting personal. And we all know that, you know, with an authoritarian narcissist, you know, if you want to dig and get under their skin, you know, make fun of them personally. So yes, he did that. But at the same time, so many of his other leaflets are just filled with not just accurate information, but it's beautifully, eloquently, in so many cases, you know, stated. You know, it's just the
case he makes.
Yeah, the case he makes. Yeah. He may not have been a Mozart, but he could have been a Mendelssohn who at 16 wrote his octet.
Well, and he loved Mendelssohn, which maybe we'll come back to that.
Yes. Yeah,
I think the idea of him being a complicated figure is important. And we should mention, early on, he was it seems like he was a supporter of, if not Hitler, certainly the Nazi idea. Is that fair to say?
No, absolutely. You know, he wrote a school essay that we have, and it's standard kind of propaganda. And in fact, in the film, Matt and his team did a wonderful job of expressing that. And that, of course, is kind of, A, to be expected, but B, also quite remarkable that he was that much of a, you know, he went along. But there was this radical change when he got better information. And when he saw in the film, it focuses on one important issue, which is the persecution and eventual death at Auschwitz of his friend Solomon Schwarz. And then there was the Reichskristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. To go out on the street and see all of the Jewish shops in glass broken, that's the name of the name of the thing, and to see the synagogues burning, that's pretty shocking. Those things combined.
So he sees the initially, if I have this right, he sees the rise to power of the Nazis as this idea that Germany is going to recover its sense of shame from World War I and its sense of purpose. Yeah. So he's like any sort of, I guess, sort of Hitler youth, I suppose,
yeah,
at the time.
He was also 8 years old when Hitler came into power.
So that's all he knew really in some way. So he absorbs it. But the thing that changes him is he starts to see not just – and this comes out in your documentary and I think in your writing – that it wasn't just the cruelty of the Nazis to Jews and others. It seemed like he was also – he had started to hear from the BBC and understand that the Nazis weren't as powerful as they were conveyed to be, and that there were incredible costs – that were going to be associated with this war.
I find it fascinating that a young man who really his whole life, from the time he was 8 years old, was just surrounded with propaganda.
Yeah.
That's all he knew. And then, of course, when his older stepbrother Gerhard sneaks home this illegal shortwave radio, he tunes into the BBC in the German language for the first time, hears truth, to put it simply, and seems to have immediately recognized it for what it is. And I've been trying to get my head around what's the equivalent? And this is not a perfect analogy, but I've thought if someone was raised and their only access to information was either MSNBC or Fox News or something, and that was it. That's all they had. And then they turn on the radio and they hear Walter Cronkite.
Yeah.
I think something like that happened, where he just immediately recognized that I'm not hearing only one side of the story. It's not, it's not Hitler's army is just dominating every single battle that they're in or thing. These things, this seems to be true. For this 16-year-old kid, it changed everything for him.
Matt Whitaker. He directed the new film Truth and Treason. It's playing in theaters in Utah. We'll put a link to the film on our website so you can get the details and the particulars. We also have with us Alan Keel. He's a professor emeritus of German language and literature at Brigham Young University. He's written a lot of things about Helmut Huebner, including the book When Truth Was Treason. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. Harmon'sGrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been discussing the story of Helmut Huebner. He was a young Mormon boy from Hamburg, Germany, who stood up to Hitler during the war. There's a new feature film out called Truth and Treason that tells his story, how Huebner used his Ward House's typewriter to write and distribute these leaflets that challenged Nazi lies. It was an incredibly risky act of defiance, and eventually he was arrested and executed at the age of 17. We have with us the film's director, Matt Whitaker, also the scholar, Alan Keel. So what do you understand as the moment when he, you know, he has this conversion by listening to the BBC and these different personal experiences? When does he decide to act, as far as you can tell, to actually do something about it, something very dangerous?
Yeah, it looks like it was in the, at the earliest, I think, would be the spring of 1941. In the film, we've had to kind of condense, you know, certain things and how they actually kind of played out. But it looks like it was in the spring of 1941. I think the earliest dates, or, you know, he makes references at a certain point. He's making references to Operation Barbarossa, to when Hitler invaded Russia and those kind of things. So we know after June 22nd, you know, he was writing more. But there were things that he was writing before that. Maybe as early as, you may have a closer on this, but maybe as early as April of 41.
Yeah. It was certainly in the spring and summer of 41.
Well, how much does it have to do with the fact that he had access to the church typewriter?
Well, that, of course, was the catalyst for the whole thing, is he had that typewriter.
You want to say, you explain to people
I'm
talking about?
Well, the branch president had asked him, because he was very talented in many ways. He knew how to type, he knew how to take shorthand, and he knew Morse code. But the branch president had said to him, look, we have these soldiers on the front from our branch, and we'd like to keep in touch with them by writing to them regularly, maybe even weekly. It seems to me that stuck in my mind. And so Helmut was given the task of typing letters to the soldiers from the branch on the front, at the front. And so he had access. There was a small portable one at first and then a larger desk model. And at some point he took that home with him. And then he had access to paper at his work. Poof, the action started.
How much of his opposition to what was going on, to the Nazis, was drawn from his faith? And let me be more specific about that. How much of that was drawn from the particulars of his LDS faith? Did he see something in his Mormonism, in the lessons that he would have learned at his, you know, ward or his branch there in Germany, that would have said something? We'll talk more about the relationship between Nazism and Mormonism in a minute. But how much of that was drawn from his faith, as far as you can tell?
I think, you see it in the leaflets. You see references to it. You know, we were just last
week. You do.
Week.
You see references to Mormonism.
Well, let me put it, to put a fine point on it. So last week we were in Berlin.
Yeah.
And we went to the Resistance Museum there, and they have this beautiful corner that's kind of dedicated to Helmut and his group. And they have in big print on the wall an excerpt from one of his leaflets, and it says, "Don't let them take away from you the most valuable thing you possess, your freedom to choose." So free agency or agency, was something he was he was writing about.
Very Mormon concept.
Yeah, again, just a very Mormon concept. But I should say, I don't see it, and Alan, you may see this differently, but reading all through his leaflets, I don't see a lot of he makes Bible references. He has a whole leaflet referencing a scripture from Daniel and comparing this Antichrist to Hitler. But
it's Christian.
It's Christian,
but it's
more,
not particularly Latter-day Saint.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about his branch, or I'll put it this way for those who don't understand the way Mormon meetings work or congregations work, his branch, his ward. Tell us a little bit. This is the St. George branch?
St. George, yeah.
It was a normal branch, a fairly large branch for the time, and it had a mix of people. There were some people in their brown shirts on Sunday. There were members of the S.A., the stormtroopers. But most of the people in that branch, as near as I can say, were very neutral. But most of them, I think, were concerned that this could blow back on them.
Hmm. What do we know? Let's back up a little bit. So in 1937, I think it was, the LDS Church president, Heber J. Grant, goes to Germany. What's the message he sends to Germans in this really tumultuous time, German members? He basically says, don't flee. Stick around. There's missionary work to be done. Everything. What's the message that he gives, as you understand it?
As I understand it, it really was just like kind of stay low. Just stay here. Stay low. Don't make waves. There's famously that there's a photo of Heber J. Grant on his visit with a huge swastika flag behind him at this whatever assembly hall that they were in, which is really fascinating to look at, of course. But that's my understanding of it, is that at that time, that was the message from the leadership of the church, was just stay low. Alan, I'm sure you can expand on that.
Well, there are those who wanted to make the Mormons and the Nazis synonymous, and they look at that flag, that photo, and say, yeah, see this? He's speaking in front of a Nazi flag. Well,
Nazi flags were everywhere.
It was a rented
they?
Hall. It was the national flag at the time.
Yeah.
And it was a rented hall. I mean, you wouldn't be surprised to go down here and rent even Kingsbury Hall and you'd find an American flag, right? And so I always think that's clearly a red herring.
Yes.
But let's do talk about what some Latter-day Saints there in Helmut Hubner's branch would have seen as some kind of connection between their faith and Hitler's vision for Nazism. One of the things, Alan Keel, you've written about was that Hitler, he didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he was a vegetarian. In some ways, he could have embodied some of these LDS virtues. And they made a kind of, I don't know what, a connection to Hitler in some way?
Yeah, this is in the realm of folklore, and it's kind of fun to examine it. There were people, Hitler was, there was a very important LDS branch established in a place in Austria, which is just about 30 miles from where Hitler was born in Braunau. And so a lot of people have conjectured that he must have gone up there and learned about the non-smoking, non-drinking stuff and the business of the Eintopfsonntag, which is the sort of one meal on Sunday.
Yeah. Say something about that because
– Well, that's a thing what Hitler –
What was it? Explain what it was.
Yeah, implemented what – again, translated, I guess, as one pot Sunday or one meal Sunday. Once a month you
– Hitler implements this for the Nazi people.
Yeah, right. You abstain from two meals. You take the money that you saved from that and give it to the poor. Yeah. Again, so members of the church are seeing this and saying, well, this is
– That's fast
it's
Sunday.
It's fast Sunday. Yeah.
Yeah. No, they clearly thought that he – I've had people in my generation tell me, "Oh yeah, Hitler joined the church up there, in Hagam, Hausruck, and that's where he got all those ideas, and that's why he didn't smoke and stuff." It's a kind of folklore, and of course people were eager to know about it because it made them feel big, you know.
There are a lot of really fascinating characters in the story, and one of them is a man by the name of Arthur Sander. Matt Whitaker, talk a little bit about him. He's the bishop, basically. He's the branch president, right?
We call him a bishop in the film, but yeah. He was the branch president.
He's the branch president. Branch, yeah. He's a committed Nazi. Is he a one-dimensional kind of bad guy in the story?
No, not at all, in the story or historically. Everybody that I've spoken with, and I spoke with everybody that I could find that was still alive that knew him personally, without exception, will say what a wonderful branch president he was, and what a faithful husband and father. Speaking with his children, and then his also his grandchildren now, who knew him, and just getting the picture of a really good man with genuine good intentions in a very difficult situation. Not to discount that, by all accounts, it seems that he did really believe, in the party, really believed in the gospel, really believed in the party, in the Nazi party, but also made some decisions and did some things that we have a hard time now looking back. How could a branch president put a sign up on the door?
Which this is an important one. Let's get to the sign. So it seems like what you're saying is he's well-intentioned. He's, by all accounts, a good man. And I guess you could say, he's like Huebner was initially. He is drawn to the Nazi party for its sort of practical effects, for the idea of giving Germans now a new purpose. But then when you get to the sign, he puts up a sign that says, "No Jews are allowed." And doesn't that turn the story?
They had one Jewish member, Zalman Schwartz, who attended the branch. And I don't know. I've never been able to gather, and Alan, you may have on this, as far as Arthur Zander's, if he had anti-Semitic views, putting that sign up in there, you would think so. At the same time, I think it's important to remember that some of the decisions that Arthur Zander made really came back to preserve the lives or bring safety to that branch and potentially, the LDS population in Germany.
So he thought that was what would be expected of a church?
I think he may have been also doing, and again, we don't know exactly his thinking, I don't think, on that, but he may have been doing things that were protecting the flock. Again, not to justify that sign or doing that at all, of course not. But to him feeling like he is the shepherd of this little flock of people the Gestapo were coming and visiting church meetings. They were coming and sitting in the back. They were watching them. Wow. We know that the Gestapo was watching the Mormons in Nazi Germany. They didn't trust them. And so I'm sure that Arthur Zander knew this and so was also making decisions to distance maybe to make sure that the Gestapo knew that we're not some American, some American cult like you may see us.
Let's talk more a little bit about that. And there is some information that's come out quite recently, a dossier that was found that gave us a sense about what it was the Nazis thought of the Mormons. And it turns out, and Alan Keel talk a little bit about this, they didn't trust him.
Yeah, there's an important find about 1 year ago in November 24 by a young man named Stephen Smoot, who's associated with BYU. But it's a 500-page dossier starting in 1933, which is right at the beginning, showing that they were being systematically surveilled. On page 26, I ran across the document surveilling a Mormon missionary from Huntsville, Utah, named Keith Jensen. And this dossier really does show that there was an animosity and there was a climate of fear in a way.
Can I come back to the flyers, the pamphlets, whatever we want to call them, the leaflets that Helmut Huebner was diligently typing out and distributing? The idea of propaganda seems important to talk about because the Germans, the Nazis, were really good at it. And it seems like that one of the things that drew their attention to this particular young man was the fact that he was good at it, and they may have recognized it. You want to say something about that part?
Yeah, I remember when I interviewed Uli Zander, who was the teenager who discovered the story. That's one of the things that he said to me was that the Gestapo was more frightened of the typewriter than they were of the pistol. They understood that guns they could take away from people, but information and the truth that was that people were believing or thinking, they understood that was more dangerous. And so,
because they understood that they'd build a house of cards built on, based on lies, and that one puff of air could take down that.
So they thought this 17-year-old kid could, in some weird viral way, create a kind of larger uprising. That idea of this being viral is something, Matt, that you really sort of connect to in the film.
Yeah, he would type at the bottom of a lot of his leaflets, this is a chain letter, pass it on, which again is the 1940s version of going viral.
Yeah. That
was his hope.
What do we know about what Adolf Hitler himself may have known? Did he know? Do we know anything about what he thought about Mormons in his country? Did he know who Helmut Huebner was?
I don't know of any direct evidence that Hitler knew specifically of Helmut. Alan, do you?
Well, I was just going to mention the fact that, your film brings this out beautifully, that there were appeals made for clemency. One was the Hitler Youth.
Yeah.
And it does not a good look to say, hey, boys, come and join our party or, you know, our movement. And of course, you could be killed. And the other one, was surprising enough, was the Gestapo. And what was the Gestapo thinking? First of all, Helmut was a minor, and they were now going to—
He was 17.
He was 16 when he was doing this, and 17 when he was killed.
Right. Yeah.
And that's an important thing, because even Germans and even Nazis were very, very meticulous about not wanting to kill minors.
Especially, I'd say, in 41, 42. By 44, 45,
It was happening. Clearly Nazis were killing people right and left.
Yeah.
But it's strange. In the legal profession, there was a real resistance to killing minors. And Carl Schnibbe had turned 18 by this time, so some of them said, well, why don't we just kill Carl? It would be a lot easier, and it would be no potential backlash.
Which seems just so crazy when you think about that. But at the time—
The film shows that very beautifully.
Yeah, it was. They were, well, hey, we've got an adult here.
Let's kill him.
Let's pin it on him.
Right. And then nobody's going to blame us for killing a young person.
And Carl talked to us about that. He saw that happening in the courtroom, and he saw Helmut seeing it happening.
Stepping up.
And really saw Helmut make a decision to stand up.
Matt Whitaker, along with Alan Keel. Matt directed the film Truth and Treason, which is in theaters right now. We'll put a link to the film on our website. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a feature film in theaters right now that tells this dramatic story about a young Mormon boy in Nazi Germany who created a small movement of resistance. His name was Helmut Huebner. The film is called Truth and Treason. We're talking about it with the director, Matt Whitaker, also with the scholar, Alan Keel. You're really interested in complicating the stories of even people like some of the Gestapo members. And you do this in this new series that you're working through. Do you want to say a little bit more about that? Because it seems like you're not really interested in this kind of binary idea of good and people either good or evil, that they're bound by these kind of incentives that are playing out. Will you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's easy for us right now to look back 80 years, 80 plus years, and see it in black and white. To see the heroic resistance fighter and the evil Nazi or the evil Gestapo, both of those things I think are true, but there was this big gray area in the middle. And that's where Germans lived out their lives in Nazi Germany. That's where they were making their decisions. When we did the documentary in 2002, had very little information about this Gestapo agent. It was diving deeper over the years of research and preparing to do the film that came across incredible information about Erwin Meusner. About this man who was complex, who would torture people and interrogate people and do horrible things during the day, would go home at night, and he was a loving and kind husband and father. I think we tend to call people like that monsters, or they were monsters. They did monstrous things. They were humans. and I think it's dangerous to just, to look at someone who's done something like that and say that, that's a monster, because in a certain way it kind of justifies, distances the horrible things that they've done from us. Erwin Meussner was a real person. What you see in the film and in the series is based in large part on what we know of what he was like. And so that's why you see these you see a complicated and complex Gestapo agent. You see a complicated and complex bishop. You see a complicated and complex Helmut Huebner, who did incredibly brave things. And again, we can look back on it and see what heroicism he showed. But he also put his family, his friends, his LDS branch in real danger. I'll never forget the first time I got to meet his stepbrother, his older half-brother, Gerhardt. I went to his home here in Salt Lake City, and he was so kind. And for me, he was really willing to talk about his brother and seemed to have a very positive perspective. His wife, Gerhardt's wife, who had also grown up in that same little branch in Hamburg, she wouldn't come in the room. And so at a certain point, I went in the other room. She was sitting at the dining room table, and I sat down next to her. And the first thing she said to me, speaking about Helmut, was, he knew he was putting all of us in danger, and he did it anyway. That informed the story that I tried to tell.
You've talked about the documentary you made now 20 plus years ago.
Yeah.
You described that as a photo of this story, while the film is a painting.
Yeah, when you're doing a documentary, you really are just trying to be factual, just getting everything as factually accurate as you can. When you're telling a narrative story on film, just by the nature of it, when you're trying to, in 2 hours, you know, tell a very, very big and complex story, you're taking multiple characters and combining them into one,
yep.
You know, or taking something that happened over 6 years and making it happen.
Compressing time frames.
Yeah. Yeah, and those kinds of things. For example.
How much license do you figure you can take, though? I mean, you have to sort of hew to the original story, of course.
Well, and in fact, that for me was my, to take an LDS term, that was my iron rod, if you will, is what actually happened.
Yeah.
And let's stick close to that. Let's hold on to that best we can. But if you've seen the film, there's this wonderful relationship that develops between Helmut and this girl at his work named Ellie. And in the story, it really kind of represents and at the end really kind of becomes what might have been. You know, that this was a 16-year-old kid who had a crush on the girl at work. Who, you know, what might have been if he hadn't stood up and did what he did, if he hadn't been executed. That's based on the actual, historically, we know that Helmut did have a girlfriend, and that there was a girl. She happened to live in his same apartment building. I took that. And so this is some of the, from photograph to painting, I took that historical fact. And I moved her into his office at City Hall.
And you made a meet cute.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Helmut Huebner was executed with a guillotine.
Yeah.
Now, how unusual was that? Was this a traditional execution technique by the Nazis?
It was at that point, yeah. In the 30s and into the early 40s. They were using it. Again, it sounds like French Revolution to us, but they were using the guillotine. One of the reasons that I've read why they did use the guillotine, again, for Nazi record keeping, time of death, if you're hanging someone, is a little fuzzy. Time of death, when you are
executing
a guillotine, boy, you could just write down exactly what it was. The problem became is that they just couldn't kill them fast enough. You know, and so the guillotine, although it was still in use even in 44-45, much less so, much more, of course, hangings where they could hang multiple people at the same time. Again, this is a morbid conversation.
No, it is.
But then, of course, Zyklon B, they were experimenting
with,
what, you know, what can we do?
And it gets to a detail that you've both sort of talked about, and that is the really assiduous note-keeping done by the Nazis. And there's a detail in the documentary, and it sort of plays out in the film, that there's 18 seconds.
We know that from the time that Helmut entered the room, the execution chamber, to the time when he was killed.
The blade fell.
When the blade fell is 18 seconds.
Yeah, it was actually broken down a little.
10 seconds and 8
seconds. Took him 10 seconds to hand him over to the headsman. Took 8 seconds for the headsman to kill him and report that the sentence had been carried out.
Right.
So I mean, that's so specific.
And it was important to me, you know, how we had to be very intentional in how we depicted that kind of an execution. Do you show it at all, you know?
Sure.
And I felt strongly that there was a right way to show it without being gratuitous. But one of the decisions that we did make was that that scene is exactly 18 seconds long. And what it leaves you with is this sense of that just happened so fast and it's over.
What do you think is the, I guess, the relevance of the film, the feature film that you've now created for the moment?
Yeah, I have two thoughts. The first one is that I've never intended this to be a message film. I will say this. Just a couple weeks before the film came out, I was sitting with Bianca Klein, my cinematographer, doing kind of a final screening of it. It was projected in a theater, watching it, making sure everything was how it needs to be. She had invited a friend of hers to sit with us. She asked if it would be all right. I met the friend briefly beforehand. I heard an accent, but I didn't ask anything about her. At the end of the film, this friend just kind of just broke down. I mean, it was common for me to see people weeping at the end of the film, but she just really broke down, kind of lost her composure. And while she was trying to regain her composure, Bianca whispered to me, she's from Ukraine. And then I kind of understood maybe a little bit better. But once this friend could speak, she said, it's not just what's happening in my country. It's what's happening in this country. She has a perspective about what she's seeing that's happening in this country. And I have to say, I've been very careful throughout this not to make this political. What's happening in our country right now is dangerous. You know, you hear people, whatever president it is, if they don't agree with him, they compare him to Hitler. I get that. Trump is not Hitler. I think he's more like Mussolini. But what you see going on in our country right now with freedom of the press and cracking down on that, with elections happening and the threat of what's going to be happening around our country, of who's going to be what, you know, what presence will our current regime administration have at these voting booths and stuff. I think it's tragic, but I think that this film and this story is very important right now.
I agree with that, Matt. And I actually heard Matt say it that after the premiere, he had some, I think people really need to know how heroic Matt has been. He wanted to start making this film back when Truth and Conviction, the little PBS documentary, was made in 2002. But in 2008, you may recall, there was a crash. And there were a lot of money lost.
We lost all of our financing.
And the financing went down the toilet. So then he gets the financing going again, and then there's this thing called COVID. And Matt did not give up. And for a quarter of a century now, he's been heroic. And at the end of the premiere, he stood up and said, you know, I'm actually kind of glad that that happened, or words to that effect, because he says, I think the relevance to the world now is greater than it was 25 years ago.
Yeah, 20 plus years ago, we were saying, boy, this film sure would be timely right now. That was nothing. And I do believe that this story transcends party politics, but I do think also that what's happening in our country right now also transcends party politics.
Yeah. This sort of illiberalism that's crept into Hungary and all these places, it comes down to truth. Because the first thing these guys do is they have their wealthy friends buy the newspapers and the TV stations. And this happened thoroughgoingly in Russia. So, you know, in Russia, the story is that Joe Biden invaded us with the help of those Nazis who run Ukraine. And people believe that because they just don't have access to any reality. So they need to have, I mean, Helmut's example is that Helmut had the radio accidentally, but we can find truth now. It's just that you have to try and you can't just swim in the Kool-Aid and say, well, everybody believes this, it must be true. You've got to consciously work against these forces that Helmut showed that he worked against. And I think it's a clear paradigm. That's why the title of my book was When Truth Was Treason, back in those days. And I love the title of the film for some reason. It sort of has a ring to it, Truth and Treason. Because those are the things this comes down to.
And they're terms that have been hijacked in the last 9 months, in the last couple of years, both the word truth and those who are being accused of treason.
That's exactly right. The average person is going to understand those in exactly 180-degree reversed way. But Helmut's model is that we all have this responsibility. And we can't take it for granted. This tsunami of lies and what I call neo-totalitarianism is actually shaking the foundations of the world's greatest democracies. The UK, the European democracies, our democracy, which has always been the light on the hill. There's a fundamental shaking going on of what we thought were permanent progressive advantages. But the Hubner story shows that it can be saved, but it has to involve a lot of people acting with the kind of courage that he had after finding the truth. You got to get the truth first.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Alan Keel. He's a professor emeritus of German language and literature at Brigham Young University, author of the book When Truth Was Treason. We also had with us Matt Whitaker. He directed the new feature film Truth and Treason, which is playing in theaters now. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can see us on YouTube at KUER90.1, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.